I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Leah Beakley. She's a designer, engineer, artist, and educator. She's former professor at MIT Media Lab. She will be teaching a workshop tomorrow, Saturday the 16th of May, at the Southside Library here in Santa Fe called Interactive Paper Sculptures, which incorporate electronics and paper and all kinds of things that we'll talk about. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. A treat to be here.
So your work explores, as you write about, intersections of high and low technologies. What do you mean by those terms?
Right. When we think about technology, I think our instinct is to focus on things like computers and electronic devices and, you know, cell phones and apps and stuff like that. And we tend to forget that nearly everything we interact with on a day-to-day basis that's man-made is really a piece of technology. So paper, for instance, is this profound, kind of amazing piece of human technology, and so are textiles and dishes and stoves and wine glasses and agriculture, and there are so many things that we don't think of in the technology frame. So that's a big part of it, kind of acknowledging that there's technology in all places in our life, and that some things we think of as high tech, and those things tend to have a lot of prestige and a lot of attention, and then other things we tend to think of as low tech, and you know, the low has a somewhat pejorative connotation. But I think those spaces are equally kind of important and profound. Part of my work is about acknowledging both of those spaces and remembering that they both exist. And then the other part is like mashing them together and seeing what we can get when we kind of take some old technologies that maybe get less attention these days and combine them with some of the new, sexier technologies. And you can get really interesting, unusual, and unexpected things when you do that.
You are part of a movement called the makers movement, and the term making has a special connotation. It's not just making art or making an apple pie or something like that, or maybe it is. I mean, what is the makers movement, and what are people making?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and you've touched on, I think, a really interesting issue that is that there's, I think, a lot of different thoughts about within the maker movement, but let me start at the beginning. So the maker movement is a somewhat new phenomenon. It's really tightly associated with a magazine that was first published about 10 years ago called Make Magazine. And it was a magazine that's kind of a revival of some of the old school technology DIY magazines, like Popular Mechanics and stuff from the 20th century. So it's a magazine that's devoted to teaching people how to make technological artifacts, and in particular working with kind of electronics and computers and things like that, although there's lots of attention devoted to things like model cars and some instruments, but generally that category of things. So it was like a revival of a certain kind of DIY magazine. And again, the first issue was published about 10 years ago, and it got a really devoted audience when it was first published. And people were excited, I think, about reconnecting with using their hands and building physical things. I think a lot of the excitement around Make Magazine was techie people kind of getting off of their computers and starting to engage with the physical world, and that was something that we in general, but maybe especially technically oriented people, had really kind of gotten away from the physical universe. And the maker movement has been, in large part, I think, a reuniting of the hand and the mind, so to speak, a reuniting kind of the intellectual side of things with the physical world, and in particular physical building and physical construction. So that was really its origin, was this magazine, Make Magazine. And then a couple of years after the magazine was first published, the magazine started hosting a fair, like an exhibition-y fair in San Francisco each year called Maker Faire, where primarily contributors to and readers of the magazine would come and show off stuff that they had made, so like techie DIY fun things that they had made.
When you say DIY, you mean do it yourself?
Yeah, so sorry about that. Yes, DIY stands for do it yourself. And that fair got a big audience and was very popular. And meanwhile, the audience for the magazine was continuing to grow. And so after the first year, Make Magazine kind of continued holding that initial fair every year and then branched out into holding different fairs around the country. So there's one, an official Maker Fair now also in New York and in different places around the world. And the quote-unquote movement just grew and grew. And it was a really passionate group of people who were really excited about building physical stuff that involved technology and then sharing that stuff with other people at venues like Maker Fair. And so that's where it started. But I do think there's, as the movement grows, it kind of goes beyond its initial kind of techie audience to a much broader audience. The term maker is somewhat ambiguous, and I think different kinds of people mean different kinds of things when they say maker. So some people mean a very broad and inclusive thing when they say make or maker that encompasses things like art or design, things like craft. And other people mean, I think, something that's much truer to the roots of Make Magazine, which is a pretty narrow, technically focused kind of making. And I think that's both given the movement some strength, because lots of people can identify themselves as makers and can identify with making things and sharing things with other people, and that's wonderful. But then I think there can be a disconnect when kind of the making that receives the most attention and kind of praise and engagement can often tend to be the more traditionally technical making. So things like, you know, building a video game might get a lot more excitement and attention than building a knitting a sweater, for example.
I mean, it seems to me that the entire history of human civilization could be construed as a maker's movement. And it's only in maybe the last century or so that we don't actually have to make the things that we use. And I sometimes think that a lot of artistic impulse comes from the fact that we miss that. I mean, it's part of being human to make the things around you instead of buying everything.
Yeah, I definitely think that's a big part of the appeal of the maker movement, is that this sense that we've gotten away from physical, kind of creative, constructive engagement with the world. And yet we as human beings, I think, really hunger for that engagement. There's a wonderful quote that I love to share that goes something like, the human being likes nothing more than to be creatively occupied with both his hands and his mind. It's by this wonderful kind of 20th century author of this wonderful book called Small is Beautiful. His name is E.F. Schumacher. He was a philosopher and really devoted to kind of continuing to make sure that there are ways for people to engage with the world, both physically and intellectually, in meaningful ways. And, of course, that has economic ties as well, as you say. Economically, it's uncommon for us to make a living these days, really working with our hands in lots and lots of jobs. That's not a feasible way to make a living. But yet, I think people really do kind of hunger for that kind of engagement. But anyway, I like that quote a lot, and his book, Small is Beautiful, is a really wonderful kind of discussion of ideas around kind of our human impulses and how that maps to economics.
Now, in this makers movement more narrowly construed, which is that kind of people getting off their computers and actually making things with their hands and combining all different kinds of materials and methods to make stuff, what are people making? What are they actually making? What are you making?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. Lots of strange and delightful things. So people are making, again, some traditional kind of technically oriented things. So people make lots of robots. So robots are a wonderful, fun thing to make. People make drones. So those are also a popular thing to make. In fact, there's a whole community devoted to DIY drone making. That's a really interesting community.
And then people are also re-engaging with craft in really, really interesting ways. So people are knitting scarves and sweaters and hats, and people are doing wonderful kind of punk needlework, and people are doing kind of painting, and people are building musical instruments, some traditional musical instruments and some kind of completely new ones. So getting to more specifically to what I do, and back to maybe the first couple of things that we talked about, I like to work at the intersection of some of the craft making and some of the techie making. So I do things that blend those two. So for instance, I have for quite a while made clothing and fashions that include electronic elements. So for example, one of the things that I made is a jacket that you can wear when you're biking that has turn signals sewn into the back of it. So you can ride around on your bike, and if you're wearing this jacket, you can signal when you're making a left-hand turn or when you're making a right-hand turn. You can also just kind of leave these lights on flashing if you want to be really visible at night. So that's an example of kind of blending the techie electronics side of making with the craft side of making, so sewing and fashion design.
That's a great idea.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, so it's a fun thing to wear. It's functional and it gets some fun attention, so that's neat too.
Now, you're exploring what you call masculine and feminine making traditions. What does this mean? What does that look like?
Yeah, so when we think about technology, I think in addition, there are lots of interesting dichotomies that happen. So one is high tech and low tech. Another tends to really break down along gender lines. And I think more specifically, I think we tend to associate high tech things with men and the things that men do and the things that men have traditionally done, I should say, and the things that women have traditionally done tend to have a somewhat lower social status generally and tend to be associated with low tech, even though those terms and those ways of thinking may have nothing particular to do with the complexity of the job being done or the sophistication of the materials and so on. So when I combine, for example, craft with electronics, I think another set of traditions that are being combined are kind of women's work, craft being things, roughly speaking, that were traditionally done by women. We think of many of those things as craft, combining that with technology, which has traditionally been a really male-dominated domain. And so I think, once again, when you take traditions and cultures and ways of working from both of those spheres, the kind of female-centered making traditions and the male-centered making traditions, you can come up with really interesting and compelling kind of juxtapositions and combinations, and you can build some things that are really new and unexamined because they draw from these universes that have been separated for a long time.
At the same time, you know, we talk about maybe feminine making traditions or whatever, but the maker movement, again, the narrowly construed maker movement, seems like a mostly male phenomenon, mostly white and Asian male phenomenon. Very few people of color, you know, African American folks and women. What's going on there?
Yeah, so that's been a really unfortunate, I think, development or some kind of an unfortunate fact about the maker movement so far. What I think has happened is that, as I mentioned, the Make magazine, when it started, was devoted to a pretty narrow audience. So it was a pretty clear audience, kind of techie guys who might want to build, you know, electronics and computer-related stuff in their garage. That was kind of the rough audience for Make magazine. But the magazine and then the kind of accompanying movement had higher kind of social aspirations than just staying a small niche kind of magazine for that specific audience. And they tend to use language that's very open and inclusive and kind of celebratory of lots of different kinds of making. And that language can be really inspiring and implies a sort of openness and kind of acceptingness and of lots of different kinds of approaches. And that has, I think, the use of that kind of language has helped the movement grow and has helped lots of different kinds of people feel like maybe they could find a place in that movement. Among other things, I think it's attracted funding. So recently, the kind of a spin-off from Make magazine called the Maker Education Initiative has received a considerable amount of funding to try to move maker activities into schools. So there's been a lot of attention and energy, but the focus on the kinds of activities that have been celebrated by the magazine and by the maker fairs and all of the big kind of headline-grabbing venues have basically continued to be the narrow range of technology projects that they started with, and the makers of those things tend, by and large, to be men and primarily white men and some Asian men. So one of my side research projects has been to kind of document the disparities there within kind of the maker movement and to kind of highlight the differences between the language that's employed by Make magazine and the Maker Fair, this very open and inclusive language, and contrasting that with the kinds of people and the kinds of projects that are actually showcased at the fair and in the magazine. And one of the things that's come out of that has just been some stats about the Make magazine and who is featured there. And in particular, looking at just the covers of the magazine is interesting. So over the past 10 years, 85% of the people on the covers are men. There has never been a black person on the cover of Make magazine, which is really just kind of crazy in over 10 years now. And in general, kind of identifiable people of color, aside from Asians, are basically entirely absent from the covers of Make magazine. So I think you can extrapolate from those kinds of stats to understand that despite the inclusive language, that at least what the kind of flagship publishing house and that company kind of thinks of as making is a very limited thing. So I've been trying to get some attention paid to some of these statistics to try to get some of the influential people in this space to open up and truly be more inclusive in the kinds of projects and the kinds of people that are celebrated in the important places within this quote-unquote movement. Because I think that's really important for the movement to truly do any good, and especially in educational spheres, which is where the maker movement really seems to be headed and seems to be largely focused.
Yeah, and as you've pointed out, it's not just, I mean, sure, there's all kinds of subcultures. I mean, maybe bringing together people who are doing macrame and people who are doing robotics could work, or maybe everybody's got their own subculture. But as you say, this subculture attracts huge amounts of money from companies like Google that are then available to the usual suspects, namely
right.
technical white guys.
Right, absolutely. That's I think, exactly why it's really important that the demographics aren't kept so limited. I mean, as this approach moves away from just being like a magazine that's, you know, bought by like boys and their dads who want to build really cool robots and is sold in education circles as, you know, as an important thing that every kid should be doing, then we really need to closely examine like who's actually being supported, who's actually being included, and so on. And as you say, part of the educational push has involved large amounts of funding, not only from private kind of foundations like Google, but also from the federal government. So they've received grants from, in particular, DARPA to expand kind of educational making. And so there are, I think, really, really important equity issues that need to be at the center of this discussion if it's going to be something that's kind of a national educational initiative that receives a lot of resources, both from private foundations and from federal sources.
When you mentioned a moment ago that you'd made a jacket that has a turn signal on it, and I was like, that's a great idea. And then I thought, is she going to patent that? And the whole maker thing is, it's so much, it seems to be so connected with openness and sharing and kind of open source mentality. How do you guys see the issue of intellectual property?
Yeah, that's a very interesting issue within the maker movement. I would say that by and large, this movement, it tends to be very friendly to taking an open source approach to intellectual property, which means you design something and then instead of kind of keeping that design secret, you actively share that design with other people freely and invite other people to copy your design and make changes to it or to make their own version of it. And that's been a wonderful way, I think in practice, that has been a wonderful way to help build community. So one aspect of the community tends to be people creating these designs and instructions to not only kind of share their design inventions with other people, but also to actively kind of help them build copies of what they've built. So you can go to websites like, for example, Instructables and find a whole library of instructions for building other people's inventions, essentially. So that's been a driver, I think, of the community and the growing community behind the maker movement. That's been really interesting and wonderful to see. They're also kind of in a similar vein, if you're interested, for example, in 3D printing, which tends to be very associated with the maker movement. There are websites where you can go and download or print out other people's 3D printing designs. And so this open source approach to design has been a definite feature of the maker movement.
You are teaching a workshop tomorrow, Saturday, at the Southside Library called Interactive Paper Sculptures. What will you be doing?
Yeah, that's right. So we will be playing around with paper and some basic electronic circuits to make folded interactive paper sculptures. So we're going to use some copper tape and LED lights and batteries. And we're going to make these flexible electronic circuits on sheets of paper that can then be folded up into custom lamps. You can also do really fun things like make pop-up books that include electronic elements. So basically it will be a time where people can come, and if they don't know anything about electronics, that's totally fine. I'll teach people just really basic, simple circuits, about really basic and simple circuits and how those work. And then we'll build a bunch of simple circuits on paper to make these glowing, interactive kind of cards or sketches and sculptures. So it will just be educational, artistic, technological, kind of playful adventure, and I'm really looking forward to it.
What ages, what would you say is sort of the lower limit?
Yeah, I would say kids as young as 6 or 7 can be really successful at doing this stuff. We're really working with paper and tape. So if you can successfully wield a pair of kid scissors and take tape off of a tape spool, you can really build this stuff. We are asking that kids come accompanied with an adult if they're attending. But yeah, it'd be wonderful to see kids as young as 6 or 7 and up to whatever, 90, 100, people are very welcome.
And that is from noon tomorrow. Leah Beakley is a designer, engineer, artist, educator, former professor at MIT in the Media Lab there, and now a resident of Albuquerque. Great to have you in New Mexico, and great to have you on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Mary Charlotte. It was a pleasure.